Hi, and welcome back to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. Well, usually the show is about climate scientists. I'll come back to that in a minute. Just a quick note on what I did today. I was invited to go up to Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, which is just up the hill from where I live. But I've never been there for the previous 6 years. I know Chris Pachorek, who works at UC Berkeley, but has an appointment also at Lawrence Berkeley. And through Chris, I was invited to give a seminar today in their seminar series. So I went ahead up there and gave what isn't my usual talk in Publishing with Nature. It's a vastly revised version of my usual Publishing with Nature talk, but it's just a talk about what we tend to publish, why we publish it, who we are, how we make decisions, things like that. And then met with a slew of scientists doing amazing work up there. And this is a fairly big part of our job, which is just getting out and meeting the communities that we're serving. And I mention it just because if you or your colleagues, not necessarily in climate science, but a different field, are interested in having a visit from a nature editor to meet you, to give us kind of seminar, if we can swing it out logistically, we'll usually try to come and visit, in particular if it's somewhere near a meeting that we're attending otherwise. So if that seems of interest to you or your colleagues, by all means, get in touch and we can try to work it out. So if you've listened to the show for the last few episodes, you've heard me talk about, well, I should really say you've heard me complain about the changes that are going on in terms of the planned levels of funding cuts for a lot of climate science and the impacts that might have on the community and the executive orders and the planned changes in policy. But you can also probably pick up that I'm not a climate policy person, and I've kept the discussion much more heavily in terms of the interviews on the physics of climate science itself. And I did talk to Susan Joy Hassel about climate communication and with Daniel Aldana Cohen about urban carbon issues and sociology, but there's been very little real discussion with people in the policy community. And I guess maybe a couple, 3 weeks ago, I started having discussions with Gretchen Goldman from the Union of Concerned Scientists. And I was honestly a little bit, I guess nervous is probably the right word about having this kind of discussion, maybe just because I don't know a whole lot about it. And so it was a little bit scary launching into in-depth discussions about topics we don't really know the material very well. But I read a piece that Gretchen had written with colleagues in science and their policy forum. It seemed really interesting, and it seemed like a discussion worth having. And initially, I had proposed to Gretchen, well, let's just have a quick chat, maybe 10 minutes, and I'll edit it into a longer interview. It's kind of like an add-on. And she very nicely said yes. But then we went ahead and had what was to me a very interesting and somewhat longer discussion. So this is still a shorter interview than usual. And there's less on the backstory of Gretchen and how she got into this kind of operation. But I like it because the UCS is an advocacy organization, but they're advocates for getting science into the policy process, not for having a particular axe to grind. And I think that Gretchen has interesting insights both on what's going on right now, really what is coming down the pipeline, but probably more important for the listenership is really how you as functioning climate scientists can potentially get involved in the policy process in a way that feels true to what you want to do as a scientist without putting you at a great personal risk. And then if you do get into problems, the resources that are available to help you through what can be a very difficult time for a lot of people who are trying to get involved in science advocacy. So here it is, my interview with Gretchen Goldman from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Gretchen Goldman from the Union of Concerned Scientists, the first ever policy guest on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So I kind of feel like you have a background and career trajectory that is remotely similar to mine in the sense that you come from a pure science background. You have degrees in engineering from Georgia Tech, but then moved into the Union of Concerned Scientists. Can you talk a little bit about what drew you to move away from pure academia into the UCS?
I was doing research on air quality and health effects at Georgia Tech in their environmental engineering department. My undergraduate was atmospheric science, and I decided I was interested in the air quality issues in particular. And so I went there to study that. And I was working on a really interesting scientific problem. It was sort of about how you use measurements and to feed into the health models that look at connections with health effects of large-scale time series epidemiologic models that assess relationships between air pollution and acute health effects. And we were looking at monitors and just statistically modeling them to see what different results you get in the model if you use different measures of air pollution around the city and try to sort of figure out what's most representative for the average person in Atlanta. So it was a really interesting scientific problem. But the more I got into it and started to think about the political context, I realized that a lot of the challenges and the reasons that we don't have better air isn't so much a scientific problem. It's not that we don't understand what causes air pollution. It's more on the political side. So I just found myself increasingly drawn to that being where the action was, and just seeing sort of my own personal niche being there. I felt like that was a better use of my skill sets to do work at the intersection of science and policy, and thinking about how to translate things, how do you get accurate scientific information into the policy space. As I got into that, I got interested in seeing what kinds of organizations existed in that space, and that led me to the Union of Concerned Scientists, because I felt like they did a good job of staying true to the science in their advocacy. So even if the truth was boring or less compelling than, you know, some messaging, you know, you might want in an advocacy setting, I felt like they were true to that science. And that was really important to me as a scientist.
So do you feel now, having been in the organization, that it is a science-focused organization, that it doesn't have an underlying ideology driving it forward?
Yeah, I've been really impressed, actually. Because I had this image and I was sort of putting the organization on a pedestal before I went there, on my first day, I was trying to prep myself, you know, like, okay, well, you know, this is just a place of work. It might not exactly meet your high expectations. but actually, it by and large, it does. It is driven by people That's that really unusual. Care about the science, and it is people that are really interested in the issues. And my group at the Union of Concerned Scientists is the Center for Science and Democracy. So our goal is really focused on the process of how science informs decision making in the government, and how we could improve that, places where it breaks down, and how that is. And so we're really looking at the bigger process as opposed to advocating specific policies on science issues. And so that also gives me more of a bird's eye view on a lot of these and thinking about it.
If you compare the UCS to some other organizations that are in the same potentially overall sphere, what about the UCS versus the Environmental Defense Fund or Greenpeace? How does it sit in that spectrum of advocacy and science?
UCS works more directly with scientists, and it stays a little more high level at informing policy. I guess a little bit more inside baseball, maybe. We don't have a grassroots game largely. We aren't at the state level as much, or in the streets in the same way. We're largely looking at federal policy for the most part, and trying to develop, I call it policy relevant research for decision makers. So translating scientific information, summarizing it, getting it into the hands of decision makers that way. And we also work really directly with scientists in a lot of ways. We have what we call our science network, which is some 20,000 scientists across the country who are interested in working with us on various projects and really looking to use their science to inform decision making. And so we work with them on all kinds of initiatives, either doing scientist sign-on letters on particular issues, working with them to speak at public meetings, connecting them with community groups that might have a need for scientific experts on a particular issue. And that's provided a lot of opportunities to get science in places where we think there should be more of it.
You've written in Science Magazine recently about what's happening right now with the current administration. And from my perspective, where, you know, I'm really not involved in the policy community, it seems like the Trump administration is completely resistant and impervious to scientific information.
and that it would almost be kind of pointless to get involved in trying to better the incorporation of science into policy. But you're thinking deeply with your colleagues about how, really, even in the current administration or in any administration, the best way to get involved and to move science more into the mainstream of policymaking processes. What do you see as being the best ways for scientists, working scientists, to get involved or become more involved in these kinds of policy issues?
I think there's a lot of opportunity for scientists to get more involved. One of the silver linings, I think, of the current situation.
Oh, there is one. Excellent. Good.
Right. Few and far between. Yeah, one of them, I think, is just that scientists are more interested in engaging now, and many of them are much more aware of a lot of these issues and
right, yeah.
How they mean. And it's been interesting, actually, working at UCS, where, of course, for a long time, we've been working with scientists to influence policy, and there's historically been a lot of scientists that really are sort of reticent to get involved in the policy space, and, you know, even signing a letter that's remotely policy.
Oh, no, I don't know about that. I could get me in trouble. I don't want to do that.
Yeah. And now it's a very different landscape. People are coming to us and saying, I already signed a letter. I want to know what else I can do. And that's the starting point. So
what is the next step after signing a letter?
There's a lot more higher level things you can do. One thing that we're working on with folks in our science network is writing op-eds in their local paper about the value of their scientific work and connecting that to some of the proposals in Congress that would gut a lot of the science-based decision-making as we know it. So there's a few proposals in Congress that would really kill the way we use science to inform decision-making. So it would either change what gets defined as science that feeds into policies, or changing who's on federal advisory committees. And so those are big threats and have a lot of implications for how we'll be able to use science moving forward.
The underlying context here is that there's this, at least it seems like, a growing anti-scientific bent in not just policy, but in large parts of the country. Is there any evidence to suggest that doing things like writing these kinds of op-eds can either forestall that or turn it in a different direction for at least some people? Or is it just more to make the scientific community feel like they're engaged?
Sure. No, I think it does have an impact, because a lot of people don't know what scientists do or how it relates to their lives. So I think that's one thing that we're finding, is that it's really helpful to be able to articulate the benefits that science has for individual places. And I think it will have an impact. I mean, on the budget, we can get into that. But, you know, for example, if they were to make giant cuts to NOAA, for example, they'd have to be able to convince members in Congress that are in districts that have fisheries that need to be managed and that need hurricane forecasting, for example. And those aren't going to fall. Those impacts aren't going to fall on political lines, right? There's a lot of red states that will have a lot of need for NOAA science and other kinds of federal science.
So, yeah, absolutely.
So I think making those points clear and how it impacts people. I mean, the broader point to me recently is that we're seeing that engagement of the broader community is having an effect on Congress and the administration's ability to get things done. So I think
you're referring to the healthcare vote, I suppose.
Most recently, yeah.
Well, let's turn to the budget a little bit now. And something that is just completely mystifying to me is the proposed budget cuts to NOAA. You just mentioned NOAA as important for hurricanes, but they do all kinds of other work as well in terms of monitoring, providing the satellite data in particular that's absolutely critical for numerical weather prediction for data assimilation and initial condition estimations. Well, first of all, maybe you can just sort of talk me through what are the proposed budget cuts to NOAA and what specific programs would that impact?
Sure. So off the bat, I do want to say that my husband works on climate at NOAA. So I just want to disclose that off the front. Yeah. So the budget cuts have been very alarming. At NOAA in particular, we saw some deep cuts around satellites and climate related work at NOAA. And so those were the more alarming pieces that I saw. And I think that has a lot of potential. And then in terms of climate science, other other departments have also seen some dangerous cuts. The other ones that we've been following is Department of Energy cuts, particularly to the Renewable Energy Office.
What kind of percent cuts are we talking here for these specific programs? Are we talking about a complete removal, or is it going to be like a 5% cut?
In terms of actual cuts, there's a few programs that are being cut completely and a lot of areas that are being cut at significant levels. The NOAA Research Office, for example, the proposed cut is 52% and 48% at EPA's R&D office. For DOE energy programs, it's 44%. So we're seeing pretty significant cuts across agencies.
I mean, that's essentially, if it goes through, a death sentence for a program like that. I think you can't sustain a 50% cut in a program and the staff loss that will entail and really keep it going. So they're basically trying to kill those programs.
Right. That's what this proposes. And so that is an important point, that this is not the budget that will get passed. There's a long process for which the budget goes through Congress, and running that gauntlet of Congress is very challenging. And so we probably don't need to be as hysterical on this as
some. Let's go ahead.
Yeah.
And it's a good point. So when it goes through the budget process, what are the underlying forces that are going to act to stabilize? Is it kind of like senators are just trying to protect the financial investment in their states? Or do you think that there's really a sense that at least some people in Congress have more of a mission to protect and support the underlying science?
I think it's probably more of the former. But I think it'll be a combination of members trying to protect resources and jobs and things in their own district, but then also public pressure potentially on these issues. We've already seen a lot of the optics of the proposed budget cuts haven't played well. For example, with the Meals on Wheels cut got a lot of attention. You know, I think that's going to definitely hold them to change this. And it's a good point to remember that the president's budget is never the one that gets enacted. President Obama's budget isn't the one that was enacted. So there's a lot of hoops that has to go through. Another prominent player in Congress is Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. And he, in his district, is Oak Ridge National Lab. And so I think, you know, he wouldn't go for a DOE cut that would be substantially restrictive to Oak Ridge. So there's lots of places like that.
And you're talking about NOAA, I'm just thinking about the GOES-R satellite that just went up, which is fantastic and is collecting some incredible data. I mean, in particular, I really like the lightning data. But when you think about the kinds of cuts that they're trying to get through, a lot of those are in cuts to observational systems. Is there an underlying subtext to why they're so keen to cut observations?
To me, it feels like the strategy is, let's not measure so we don't have to manage. It seems like we're seeing that from a few areas with the multiple satellite cuts that would measure climate and have many other benefits to business and the private sector as well. But we're seeing them cut some of those missions, and then also the proposed budget from the president looked at cutting other observational programs in a few places. So that is one thing that I think seems like it might be a strategy of this administration.
So you could just say, I'll go, well, you think the temperatures are going up in the lower troposphere. We have no data for that. We can't possibly take any action because we have no information.
Yes, that's the irony, too, is the OMB director, Mick Mulvaney, did say that, too. You know, we just need to study climate a little more before we could take action. But yeah, They're conveniently making sure that's not as possible. We'll see.
Life abounds in intended or unintended irony, right?
Right.
DOE is an interesting specific example because all of their employees, well, not all of them, but the vast majority of them are not federal employees. They're contractors. And in that sense, they're much easier to get rid of. And I've talked to people in DOE who have specifically said that after the announcement of the proposed cuts, they've already begun to change their, you know, things like their social media postings or what they're willing to say specifically about climate change. Do you have the sense in discussions with the scientific community that people are already self-editing? In other words, has just the announcement of the proposed policies and cuts had the effect of clamping down on scientific discourse?
I am really worried about that. We're creating a chilling effect by even seeing this as the president's priorities. It feels that this science isn't being valued. And so I'm really worried about the potential for self-censorship. One of the earlier examples that we saw was the CDC canceling its climate change conference that was scheduled.
Yes, right.
And that was even pre-inauguration. It wasn't even the new administration yet, and they went ahead and decided to do that. And as far as I know, that seemed to be a case of self-censorship in that they just decided it wasn't going to be politically a good idea to move forward with that. And so I'm really worried about how that's going to play out across agencies. And then on sort of a related point, the other thing I've worried about is that there starts to now be this narrative where if you're in a federal agency and you're communicating climate change, then you're being defiant. There's been a few articles that have sort of framed it that way. And I think that's a dangerous precedent. We don't want to get into a place where people communicating accurate science is somehow defiant or choosing to be rebellious against the administration.
There is a huge gradation of the way that scientists engage in discussions on climate. I mean, there are people like Dave Keeling who never discussed the implications of their science, but just took these amazing data that have had a revolutionary impact on the subsequent discussions of climate science. And then there are people who are active, successful, functioning scientists at a very high level, but who are also very, very involved in the policy implications. And there can be a perception, I would argue usually inaccurate, that by engaging in the policy discussions that the scientific community or parts of it have now transitioned into being advocacy people themselves, and therefore lose the scientific objectivity that you know the public would like them to have. What advice do you have for people who are sort of, you know, interested in getting into that discussion of the policy issues, but not being seen as an ideologically driven advocate?
It's a good question. This is an issue that often comes up for scientists as they struggle with that. And I think in a lot of ways, it's sort of an antiquated dichotomy, but that it persists. And scientists are somehow always receiving this message that I can't advocate for my science or else that puts me in the advocacy space and then I'm not being impartial. Right. I think that perception is changing some. I think younger scientists feel that barrier less than perhaps the older generation who have fresh in their mind the idea of, you know, the bigger example is always Carl Sagan, who was a very effective public communicator on science and did, at least the perception is that he didn't advance as far in his academic career because of that focus on outreach and public engagement. Mm-hmm. So I think people have that sort of image in their head. So I think it's changing a little bit now. And then the other point is, I think we're just in a different era, that it's not the same as if this was happening 5 or 10 years ago. The science march, to me, is a perfect example of that. And that, you know, who would have predicted that the scientific community would be ready to march in the streets around these issues? I certainly did not think it was going to go that direction. You know, and even sort of early on, I don't know if you went to the rally that was at AGU this year.
I didn't go, but I'm aware of that it happened. And it was about 500 people or something like that.
Yeah, so I, you know, we were involved with talks about that in advance of it, and I really did not think it was going to be successful. I thought I thought scientists aren't going to be interested in this. This is sort of, you know, not the context. AGU is a more sort of, you know, serious research place. I just didn't think it was the right venue. And I was completely wrong. It was very successful and it got tons of attention and we got many climate scientists to participate and stand on stage in their lab coats. And to me, that just spoke to, we're just really in a different context than we used to be on these issues.
One enduring context for the discussion of climate science in particular has been, I don't know what to call it exactly, but kind of the character assassination aspects of it, going back to the, you know, the early Mike Mann days and before, and having to confront the fairly organized machinery of personal attack that is in the wheelhouse of climate denialism or whatever you like to call it. How do you think that scientists can best navigate that kind of, you know, very thorny and uncomfortable and just difficult and challenging, very public discussion?
It's a challenge. There's lots to navigate, but there's also lots of resources available for scientists to promote our own stuff. The Union of Concerned Scientists has a guide for science under scrutiny, it's called. So basically what to do if you are a subject of political attacks or Freedom of Information Act requests or other sorts of personal attacks that have happened. And then we also have a lot of webinars and other things where we walk through how to talk to the media, how to talk to members of Congress, how to communicate your science in effective ways for different audiences. So I think there's a lot out there, and there's also a tremendous amount of support for science and scientists now. So I think if you stick your neck out, so to speak, you're not alone, whereas you might have been previously. There's a lot people can do, and just getting familiar with the landscape, I think, is helpful in advance, and talking with folks who are more seasoned in this space can be helpful. And I think it's not as scary as it might have seemed once.
Well, maybe we can kind of wrap on a totally existential note, which is the current discussions about the budget and the anti-science movements and the rejection of climate science. At least for me, it kind of, it's a real slap in the face in the sense that it makes you question, okay, are we actually abandoning the age of reason? Are we abandoning objective reality and the pursuit of scientific truths, as uncertain as they might be? But then, as you say, there's this large community backlash against that. And what I'm actually getting a feeling for now is that people have a heightened sense that we're involved in a collective enterprise for the pursuit of scientific advance, irrespective of ideology or where it actually might lead us. But, you know, this is just me. When you talk to people in the scientific community and in policy and in Congress, do you have that same kind of a sense on the rebound effect against this, or am I just being completely fantastical?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, I think I too sort of once we started seeing a lot of the old tired climate denial points sort of resurface in the mainstream, you know, I was also like, are we really back to that? We really haven't evolved past CO2 is not a pollutant kind of narrative,
right?
With Administrator Pruitt's comments recently. I was disheartened by that, but I think we're in just such a different time that there are a lot more people watching and ready to hold decision makers accountable in a way that maybe wasn't the case 10 years ago in the same way. So I think, you know, one example sort of recently was the House Science Committee, which is, of course, supposed to be supporting science, but they just tweeted out some climate denier article about climate, and I saw it and I thought nothing of it because it was something that was typical of what they do. But it actually got really big, and there were entire articles devoted to it and people calling them out on it and talking about how inappropriate it was for them to be misinforming on climate science, and people really would not let it go. I ended up writing a blog post that got seen by 6,000 people, I think more than that, but the Facebook likes are 6,000. But yeah, so it just showed to me that there was this tremendous pushback now, and we're not willing to let things go in the same way that we maybe used to. And so I think we do need to all make sure we're not too cynical on it and hold members to a standard of accepting science, which of course shouldn't be so tall of an order. Right. So, and then another sort of point, this is somewhat a different point, but another sort of longer term thing that I think about a lot, and we touched on this a little, was the impact this is going to have on younger scientists, people in graduate school or just starting their careers. You know, my undergraduate was atmospheric science at Cornell, and I started to get into different environmental issues. And so I could have and maybe should have just studied climate science in graduate school. But at the time, I thought to myself, that seems like very political. It seems like I'd have to spend more time arguing for my science than actually doing it. And so I didn't. I went to study air pollution and I switched to environmental engineering. You know, of course, I made my way back and now, of course, chose to put myself in the policy arena. But it does make me think of if there's other young scientists that might be doing that kind of calculation. And I wonder if it'll select for, you know, only a certain subset of people that really want to be in that space. So that's another thing that I'm ongoingly thinking about and worried about.
Yeah, that definitely could happen. But I think There was some discussion about from potential graduate advisors who were sort of saying, should I even be taking grad students in this current environment? I mean, are they going to have jobs, most of which are to some degree federally funded? But the other thing to keep in mind is that there is international science. And I've talked to multiple people who have either gone to Canada or have left Canada, depending on the political environment at the time. So it isn't like if you get a PhD in pure climate science in the US that you have to think only about having a career in the US. It's a global enterprise.
Yeah, that's a good point. That science is so global now that we really aren't restricted in any way, and there's lots of opportunity still.
Gretchen Goldman from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you very much for the first ever policy discussion on Forecast. That was terrific and very informative for me.
Thanks for having me, and glad you were open to the policy idea.
That was Gretchen Goldman from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Gretchen, thanks for reaching out for a great conversation. If you'd like the show, you can subscribe to it on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. You can reach me through Twitter at MWClimateSci or email. I'm forecastpod@gmail.com. The show notes are at forecastpod.org. I'm kind of going with a shorter version of the show notes these days. Just something that's a little bit more concise. So I hope that's working out well for everyone out there. And just kind of coming back to the whole idea of the site visits, I'll be in the East Coast, primarily in Maine, for most of July and August of 2017. So if you're out there and thinking that you'd like to see a nature editor, we might be able to work something out. Please get in touch. Love to hear from you. I'll talk to you soon.